Welcome to No Ceilings. This is your host, Nathan Grubel. After a very long hiatus from the YouTube and podcast worlds, I'm back hosting a very special episode of the No Ceilings NBA podcast with a guest who there's a bunch of different reasons why I wanted to have someone like him on, and we're going to get into a lot of it. But personal trainer, works with a lot of different players across the NBA and the basketball landscape, someone who's involved in player development and coaching, someone who is definitely there for his players and his clients. And you might know him best for his work with Damian Lillard in the Formula Zero camp. That is Phil Bechner is joining me on a podcast today. What's up, Phil?
Nate, man, I'm pumped to be here with you, ready to talk some hoops. I know you've been pursuing this for a little while, so I'm excited to get it going.
Oh, it's always a great day when we can talk about hoops, especially with some of the conversation we're going to have today. And if you're listening to this podcast or you're watching this on YouTube, we're recording this on November 6th. Eventually, you're going to find a piece on NoCeilingsNBA.com. Please subscribe to No Ceilings NBA if you haven't already. You're going to find a piece on there from me that's specifically talking about what in the heck is going on with Ryan Dunn's shooting explosion. We're not going to center this entire episode around Ryan. We do want to talk about shooting and the development that goes into shooting as a skill as a whole, but it's certainly been a topic of conversation around the NBA in the first few weeks of the season. And listen, I already wanted to write pieces more catered to developing specific skills. I already wanted to interview some player development coaches as it was. This is a little bit sooner than I was expecting to make some of that content, to be honest. But when Phil agreed to come on and have a conversation about shooting and what kind of goes into this work and how do these young players actually develop along those lines, I couldn't say no to the opportunity. I'm glad that he accepted my invitation to come on. But before we get into a lot of the nitty-gritty basketball stuff, Phil, I just want to ask you for the audience, right? What is your background specifically working in basketball as a trainer, as a skill development coach?
Yeah, my background's a little bit different than a lot of skill trainers now or a lot of player development coaches now, because now the skill training aspect has really become a profession, you know, outside of the NBA or even for college kids or high school kids. It seems like anyone and everyone now is a basketball trainer. I played small college basketball myself. I'm actually really proud to say that I pretty much coached at every level. I was a JV high school coach, assistant varsity coach at the high school level, spent 10 years coaching at the Division I level, coached in the D-League. I've consulted with some different NBA teams, trained different NBA players. So my background's a little bit different. I consider myself more of a player development coach, or, you know, just an old school coach still. But obviously a lot of these guys now, the cliche term is basketball trainer. So I've kind of done it anywhere and everywhere, you know, all different levels, and kind of makes my experience unique. And, you know, that's what makes it, you know, exciting to talk about.
No, 100%. And that's why I'm glad to have you on. I'm proud that and happy to hear that you consider yourself a coach first and foremost, because that's honestly relationships, anything you can do working with players, specifically developing that type of coach-player relationship. That's what this game's all about. It's such a beautiful thing to hear. I mentioned at the top, obviously you're famous for, you know, having your relationship with Damian Lillard and working with him. And how did you meet Dame specifically, and what's kind of that journey been like working with him throughout his career? Like, what are some of the lessons you've learned from working with him and vice versa? What are some of the biggest things, you know, he's learned working with you?
Sheesh, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. I keep saying one day we need to do like Dame and I on a podcast together. There would be probably a lot of stories that have gotten blown out of proportion over the years. There'd probably be some language that would have to be edited out, you know, over time. You know, like I was telling a story the other day at Formula Zero Camp about him and Tim Frazier, some guys I trained, you know, forever in the league and worked with. And we got done, and Dame's like, that didn't exactly happen that way, Phil. Like, you're blowing it out of proportions. So Dame and I's relationship, like, over time, it's like the person who caught the fish, the fish gets bigger every year. You know, you tell the story. And he's such a special player, and he's such a special human. It's really easy to talk about. But I actually started coaching him when he was a freshman at Weber State. So I was on the staff there at Weber State. He came in, I think, my second year there. And, you know, we started working together a little bit freshman year, and it just kept going and going. A lot of workouts, a lot of arguments, a lot of fights, but, you know, a lot of great things, too. And then, you know, obviously he got drafted, you know, had a phenomenal start to his NBA career. I kept coaching college. Again, I worked in the G League for a year during that time. But then about we're actually on year six, I decided to leave college coaching. You know, I was tired of the recruiting stuff, just the mess, the direction it was about to head with the transfer portal, all the stuff going on now in college basketball. Mm-hmm. There are a few NBA teams that reached out, wanted to hire me. And Dame was like, you ain't working for them. I want you to work with me. So, you know, I kind of did something different, really followed God's will. I think God's calling, you know, on my life and said, hey, I'm going to go into – you know, this basketball training, this player development realm on my own. And so then I really became his full-time trainer for the last 6 years basketball-wise. So again, like I told you, you know, before we jumped on, I'm in Milwaukee right now, and in about 2 hours, we're going to go do some of his in-season development stuff, keep him sharp, keep his mind right in the right place. And so we've been at it for a very, very long time together, you know, now with Dame.
I didn't necessarily write this question down, but I have to ask, given that, you know, you said yourself, you've worked with Dame since his freshman year at Weber State, and he's had, I mean, not to try to just flatter you or him, but he's had a career. I would certainly put him up there for arguments in terms of, like, I don't know, top 10 point guards of all time in the NBA. I think he certainly has an argument. Like, what has it been like watching that rise from where he started during his college career to ultimately where he's at now? Like, what has that kind of been like for you?
Nate, I don't even know if you could describe it, because there have just been so many things that were unexpected. You know, like you just said, maybe he's a top 10 point guard all time. You know, those things are always debatable. One mm-hmm. thing I'm super proud of him about, that we were actually just talking about this offseason, because, you know, last year he struggled. There were some things body-wise, mind-wise, personal and professional, both on and off the court, that he had to mm-hmm. figure out. And, you know, even starting Formula Zero, where we're trying to impact that next generation of players, this is stuff we tell them. But if you look at Dame pound for pound, talent or no talent, I think he could really look in the mirror and say he got the absolute most out of what he was giving. Like, he maximized everything he had and maybe even went over that a little bit. So, you know, to really answer your question, over time, I think it's just being able to zoom out and see that this dude was doubted, disrespected at times, you know, came from Weber State, went to Portland, ended up being, you know, rookie of the year, NBA All-Star Game MVP, multiple times NBA All-Star, top 75 player all time. For someone to do those things, it took a lot more than talent. And that's what I admire most about his journey, just seeing the behind the scenes, how hard it is, but the character, the resilience, you know, the mentality he has had to separate himself, like that's a big part of what we try to do player development wise with the next generation of players, with him being that ultimate example.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Everything about the game from a mental standpoint, it's one thing in terms of physical talent, but it's a whole nother thing when you talk about what does it actually mean to be a professional in the NBA. Those conversations are always fun to have. Before we dig into something specific like shooting, and especially in relation to the young players coming into the NBA, what is it like working with Coach Phil Beckner? Take us behind the curtain a little bit. When a new client comes to you, like what are some of the things that they can expect from you as a coach, and what are some of the things they can expect to work on, and what do they need to be prepared for when they're working with Coach?
I'm going to have to get this clipped and send it to all my clients, especially the young guys, because what I say is maybe not exactly what they would say. But the number one thing I'd say is it's going to be different, and it's not going to be for everybody, because we have a holistic approach to development. And you just alluded to it, developing professional habits and fulfilling professional standards. And, you know, when we get to Ryan Dunn, we'll talk about that. But to me, character and maturity really, really matter. It really, really separates. So our approach is going to be different. I'm going to really try to get to know these guys. If they don't like me, I'm okay with that. If they're not going to be okay with being held accountable and held and being told the truth, I'm going to tell them to go train or work with someone else. I don't train 9 million guys. I train the guys who have a purpose. They're not just going to be the top 5 picks every year in the draft. I want guys who have a purpose in their life, who have a mission in their life, but they know we're going to have to be connected. They know it's going to be a holistic approach to their development, both on and off the court. And they know they're going to be told the truth and held accountable. And that's what I mean different. I'm not just saying we're better than everybody else, but we are very different in that aspect. But we truly believe we're going to get results when we do it that way, especially over time.
100%. I mean, if you aren't getting that level of buy-in from someone you're working with, I mean, at the end of the day, player development, it comes down to how much you ultimately put into it. So if you're not getting that buy-in right out of the jump, I mean, how much improvement in terms of exponential development can you actually expect? I love hearing that. We're going to take a quick short break, and when we come back, we're going to dig into the real meat and potatoes of why Coach Phil Beckner's here on this podcast. All right, back here with Coach Phil Beckner. The biggest reason why I wanted to have you on this podcast today, Phil, is to talk to you about shooting development. And shooting is about as big of a buzzword as you can find around the NBA today. I mean, we can talk about all the different analytics when it comes to, you know, offensive ratings being record highs and the number of three-pointers being attempted being record highs. I mean, you watch the Boston Celtics for 5 minutes and you can see where the game's gone in terms of threes. But when we talk about young player development and specifically shooting development coming in, how many clients would you say that you've taken on have had to make legitimately serious improvements to their shooting, i.e. going from like below average to good, more so than just like the good to great type of improvement?
Yeah, tough question to answer because I'm, you know, I love analytics too, and I would like to look back on every client to answer that, and I could tell you which ones. But I will say this, and this is going to be a super fun, exciting conversation for me, because one phrase we have in development, we always say it, and I actually do a clinic now in Phoenix where I bring out college coaches and different high school coaches to teach some of the stuff we're doing. But we always say shooting is the separator. And it's exactly why you're asking about Ryan Dunn or where the Celtics are heading now. Or, you know, I think it was 6 years ago when I was talking to the Spurs about a few things. Like, the guys who could take and make threes will take their development to the next level. So a lot of guys I've worked with, I would actually say there's very few who have gone from just like good. What we say, here's how we classify it. You're either going to go from good to great or great to elite. But most of them are trying to get to that place of good and doing it at a very consistent level. They could be good for a day or maybe a couple of weeks or a month or two, but can you be good over the course of an 82-game season? Or can you be great? You know, so I would actually say the trick to your question there is, you asked about young guys. Most young guys, they really need this development to get at a good, sustainable level for the NBA.
No, 100%. So sticking with the theme of young guys coming in, specifically talking about NBA rookies, right? So generally, NBA rookies shoot about 30 to 31% on average from three-point range. That's numbers I've looked at in the past doing studies over the last like 8 to 10 years. This season, it's about 27.4% across all rookies. If you just eliminate those who haven't taken 10 or more threes, if you just look at 10 or more threes, it's about 28.6%. So even a little bit down from that average. But I've been asked this question on other podcasts, and I'm certainly not equipped to answer it as well as somebody like you. You're someone who works with players on a day-to-day basis. Yeah. So I have some theories about why some players come in and struggle from the NBA line, depending on like what type of shooter they are, what environment they're in. But what are your thoughts around, you know, some of the shooting struggles you might see from young players coming in, and why the majority of rookies struggle adapting to that line so early on in their careers?
Yeah. There's you know, different ways to look at this. You could look at it individually with each kid, you know, each player and their mechanics. You could look at it from a straight analytical analysis. There's a lot of shooting coaches, you know, shooting gurus now. I hate that term, because most of the time, if you're going to get paired with a shooting coach, like, those players are going to run from you. They don't like Doc. I got to work for 2 years as a consultant with Doc, and Doc always calls me Dame shooting coach or the Sixers shooting coach when I was there with those guys. And I'm like, but we do ball handling, we do player development. You know, there's more that goes. So I kind of have that more holistic approach. So when I look at shooting with young guys, we could look at it individually with their mechanics. Okay. That's one whole conversation. We could look at it analytically. Okay. How many do they attempt? The NOAA analytics are really, really good now. You know, the depth of their ball, the height of their ball, you know, that type of stuff. Obviously, the distance has just increased for them, right? You know, going whether it's from high school to college, college to the NBA. But here's the three things in general I think players could really prepare for overall, or development coaches could prepare for overall when going to that next level to help those percentages. And Nate, honestly, most guys just aren't good enough, like skilled enough. They're not skilled enough, or they're just not strong enough to combat these three things. And the three things we talk about with clinics, whether it's with Dame, one of the best shooters of all time, or a guy like Jacoby Walter, who I worked with in pre-draft, or Ryan Dunn. These three things are the same across the board. When you get to the pro level, speed of the game is going to be way faster. So they got to be able to compete and play and execute and make a shot with the speed of the game increasing. The distance of the line has increased. We already hit that. So speed, distance. And then the other thing, and especially at the pro level, because most of it's four out, five out, and you're playing with two, most teams have two dominant ball handlers or two dominant high usage guys. The third part is movement. Maybe it's sliding down to the corner. Yeah. Maybe it's, running from one wing to the other. Dribbling off a pick and roll is a movement. A shot fake, sidestep, one dribble. And, you know, I've got to work with guys like Cam Johnson the last 3 years, you know, a phenomenal NBA shooter, where Cam still had to work on beating the speed of the game and beating movement at times. So for a young guy to get to the NBA, remove analytics, right? Remove mechanical adjustments. If he can't beat the speed of the game, if he can't beat the distance that the line's at now, or he can't beat the movement that he's put in, he's not going to make any shots. And I think that's really, really hard for guys to get better at, unless they're being prepared for it, you know, behind the scenes or before they get there.
No, 100%. I think those are three excellent factors that you hit on, and I want to get your opinion. I want to throw a potential fourth one into the ring, get your thoughts on this, because I was talking with an agent the other day about a specific topic like this. And I thought about the idea of when guys are coming into the NBA, they don't necessarily know fully what to expect early on in terms of the types of minutes they're actually going to get. Mm-hmm. How often are they actually going to get on the court? When they're on the court, when is their first shot attempt going to come? Are they even going to get a shot attempt in their first, you know, few, five, six, whatever minutes on the floor? Like, how much do you think that overall rhythm also plays into a factor in determining whether a player's coming in hot from three, or it takes them a little bit of time to adjust?
Yeah, Nate, that's everything, though, in life. Think about it. And again, I speak to different – no, seriously, like I speak to different organizations. I'm actually speaking to the Army National Guard, you know, in January about how to increase performance, whether it's their leadership team or the people under the leaders. Just think about this. Certainty equals confidence. Whenever we have certainty in life, we're going to be more confident. And I know we'll get to the Ryan Dunn stuff here in a second, but the more certainty we could give a player, what role they're going to play, where they're going to shoot it from, when they shoot it from there. I thought you were going to bring up length, actually, because these dudes are so long. It's we can't control that.
That goes into the speed of the game, right? That goes into some of what you were talking about before, like these hard closeouts
I'm at the Suns game the other night. Anthony Simons, a client of mine for five years now, however long he's been in the league. And again, he's built this shooting stuff from day one, but he was a good shooter. But now I think he's starting to tip the scale to have a chance to be an elite one, at least off the dribble, you know, from three and from the free throw line. But when these guys have a level of certainty, it gives them confidence. They know when those shots are going to come, where they're going to come from. And I think too many times, like I've done this drill. I heard Steve Kerr used to do this, and I used to do this with Anthony Simons before he was starting with the Trailblazers. I'd let him shoot like two or three shots, make him do a closeout, and then have him go just sit on the bench in the Portland Trailblazers practice facility. And he's like, "What are you making me do?" I'm like, "You're going to sit there." And I would literally just wait for like 3 minutes to tick off on my watch, which seems like forever. I'm like, "All right, I want you to run to this corner and you got to make this three. And if you don't make the three, I'm subbing you out for another 2 minutes." And it just, he loved it, but it got him, you know, prepared a little bit emotionally, you know, for those situations.
100%. One quick question that ties into some of that before we take another short break and we'll get into Ryan specifically. But we hear, and when I say we, I'm talking about the general public, right? We hear so much about, you know, during the pre-draft process, if so-and-so could shoot, right? And you alluded to a point earlier on in our conversation about some guys just coming in, they just aren't flat out good enough to just, you know, shoot at that level and play at that level right out of the gate. But when we talk about that, if so-and-so could shoot, like realistically, what actually needs to go into a player's shot development? And just speak a little bit about what that variation is from player to player. Cause I'm a firm believer that 100%, like it can be something completely different when you go from player X to player Y, but just kind of a touch on that a little bit and speak about that for the general audience.
You're going to get me fired up about this one though. Because no, seriously, because what you just said is correct. You said, when you go from like player X to player Y to player Z, it's all different. Like, this guy might need to get his elbow under the ball. This guy might need to get his footwork correct. This guy might need a more fluid, you know, rhythm. And again, there's all these shooting experts out there. I don't claim to be one. We've had phenomenal results with guys, you know, but again, our way is not for everybody. And it's not like we've been able to fix or help everybody. But here's what I'm passionate about. And here, like, I'd die on a hill for this one. With all these young guys in the NBA, everyone says, like, if they could shoot the ball, they would do this. And think about what this might be. It might be you go from being a G League guy to actually a two-way player to having a legit contract. Legit contract to being a legit role player, or role player to starter, or, you know, whatever it may be. And that's why I always say shooting is the separator so many times, especially at the pro level. But, Nate, here's what happens. One, the player doesn't freaking stick with it. If it's going to work, this is not a quick fix, quick thing. Like, I just brought up Anfernee Simons. That dude did work for 3 years behind the scenes, just small gains, marginal gains, maybe a big gain after a while. But the majority of players I see in pre-draft, or even players who approach me and want me to work with them, I'm going to look them in the eye and be like, you're not going to stick with this. Whether you're bringing me to town or bringing my assistant to town twice a month, or you're going to do our foundational program every single day, number one, Nate, they will not stick with it. And then the second thing that happens, there's so much ego in basketball, whether it's the player's agent, the player's, again, basketball trainer, the player's front office, the player's development coach on staff. Everyone wants credit for who made who good. And like, when you look at Dame Lillard or Anfernee Simons or some of these guys I've got to work with, I was not the only one developing them. Man, Ant's dad, I tell this all the time, growing up, Anfernee Simons' dad knows basketball and got that dude better. Dame had a phenomenal AAU coach. Dame had David Vanterpool. It takes a village. It takes a group to do this. So one, the player has to stick with it. And then I would tell Doc this all the time when I was a consultant. Everyone now in the NBA says, like, hey, that player just needs one voice, just one voice in his head about shooting. I've changed that because I want to work collectively with great people and continue to get these guys good, because we can't be there all the time. I said, they don't need one voice. They just need one sound. It all sounds the same. We're all doing the same things, same terminology, same teaching points, whether it's Phil Beckner teaching them or the assistant from the Bucks teaching them. Let's all sound the same, because going back to it, certainty equals confidence. We also know high clarity equals high performance. So you got me fired up with that one a little bit. But the reason why these dudes don't make that jump, one, they just won't stick with it. And then two, too many people try to get involved and it gets all screwed up from there.
100%. And we'll definitely get into some mechanical stuff with Ryan. Listen, you're a very humble coach, because you talk about shooting, and it's not also you guys, but you work with one of the best shooters in the NBA, period. So you are a very humble coach. But you also open the door with Ant Simons, though, and I didn't necessarily write this down either, but Ant's development as not just a shooter, but as a scorer and as a player overall in the NBA has also been something that's been incredibly fun to watch. Like, I've been scouting and trying my hand at the scouting game since about 2011, and so I remember watching the grainy the high school stuff of Ant Simons, because he didn't go to college. He spent an extra year after high school, and he went to IMG, and he got drafted in the 20s, and not a lot of people knew who he was. Literally no one knew what to expect from a teenager coming into the NBA who hadn't played on a college floor. What's his development sort of been? I know I asked you about Dame, but what's Ant's development been like, and what have you been able to take away from it and watch as well?
Man, he, again, and you say why I'm humble. Probably not everyone would say that. You do got to have a little, but you do got to have a little swagger or confidence.
Right.
That's why, like, I know sometimes I say some stuff that I'm not too proud of, like to some of these pre-draft guys, like, hey, you don't want to listen to me. Why don't you go look at all the framed jerseys that I got in my house right now? Like, those dudes listen to me, but you're 19 and you don't want to listen to me. So I'm not always the most humble when it comes to approaching the players, I guess, getting my point across. Honestly, but again, giving Ant the credit for my humility and giving Dame the credit for my humility, like, those dudes are so freaking special. Like, it's not about me and my team. Now, have we done great? Do we serve them well? Do we train them well? Do we show up for them probably when a lot of other people wouldn't have showed up? Absolutely. But when you look at the developmental process of these guys, Ant has a phenomenal set of parents at home. He's had a phenomenal agent around him. Same thing going back that first staff when he was with Terry Stotts in Portland. They had Nate Tibbetts helping work that dude out, every day that I wasn't there. But going to there's some great articles, I think, on The Athletic about Ant and his growth. Because like you said, he was that 19-year-old skinny kid. I always tell the story about when he wanted to eat cereal before a workout one night. I had just gave the greatest motivational speech ever. Like, you got to figure it out. And he's like, hey, let's go. I'll watch film in here. I want to eat cereal before the, and I'm, but here's what he did. It goes back to what I said. He was willing to look in the mirror and take ownership of his development. Dad could challenge him. Phil Beckner could challenge him. Terry Stotts, Dame Lillard, and CJ took him on. Everyone could challenge him. But when you look at young players like him who have the character and the resolve but also take the ownership of their development, I'm working with one of the top high school kids in the country right now. I'm not going to say his name. I don't put that stuff out there. But, I make that kid read a book right now. I make that kid get to his workout early. I make that kid set up his film time with me. I don't set it up. Like, those professional habits that'll be separators. Anthony Simons, you might have to beep this out, but he used to call that all of Phil's bullshit. Like, Phil wants me to dribble the ball hard a certain way. Phil wants me to show up on time. Phil wants me to text back, and he called it Phil's bullshit. And now it's like Ant separators. Ant does that stuff. We were in a gym in Orlando, and we were sitting there, and he goes, it's so funny, seeing these guys grow up and his developmental process. He goes, Phil, you know what drives me nuts now? What really irks me? And Ant's a real quiet guy. Like, not much bothers him. I said, what's that? He goes, when players don't pound the ball hard. And I go, Ant, me and you damn near had fist fights about pounding the ball hard for over a year of your development. But that also goes into shooting development. Because if they don't pound the ball hard or they can't get these ligaments and fingers strong, they're not going to have a strong, tight shot, which I know we'll get into some of those breakdowns later. But those were some of the things. But when you look at it, Ant had great people around him, great, teammates around him, Dame, CJ. But then also, he just took freaking ownership of it. And he went from, whatever he was drafted, the mid-20s to $100 million player now, averaging over 20 points, a game. I think he was almost top five in free throw percentage last year. Shoots the heck out of it off the dribble, from three and pick and roll. So super, super proud of that one and his story.
First off, Phil, be yourself, bud. Don't be afraid to swear on this podcast. If I had to adhere to that rule that I probably broke on the very first Draft Deeper episode I ever recorded, I wouldn't be doing this right now. So we're all good on that front. But I just, before we take a quick break, I just hope that everyone out there is listening to this and digesting what Phil's actually talking about. Because notice how much we actually haven't gotten into discussing, the specific talent of a player. We're talking about everything that's up here. We're talking about their commitment, the types of people they have around them, the mindset that they have. There's so much that goes into excelling at this game that is far from just the God-given talent that they've been born with. And I just hope that everyone out there is digesting that as we continue to go along this podcast. But one more quick break, then we're going to get into some Ryan Dunn and some analytical stuff, some fun numbers I like to look at.
There we go.
All right, back here, Coach Phil Beckner. Whole reason why you're here, Phil. The reason why I'm writing the piece I am for No Ceilings is Ryan Dunn's shooting development. You can say it's an outlier. I'd argue it's an outlier among outliers. And the reason why I say that, right, it's for a few, but we can give a numbers reason. Then we can go into some of the breakdowns behind his shot and what other young players can take away from his development. But I wanted to do a specific study about some of the young shooters in the league right now, right? And so I took a look at 41 players in the NBA as of today, or really since yesterday, pulled these numbers on 11-5, who had three-point percentages of 34% or greater right now. Understand, small sample size, 6-7 games. You know, yeah. Don't shoot the messenger. Just looking at what I can look at now, right? Of those 41 players, 44% of those players in their pre-draft season had attempted 150 threes or more, right, during that season. 73% attempted 100 or more. Ryan Dunn attempted less than 40 threes in his pre-draft season in college. I think the number sits around 58 in terms of the number he took at Virginia altogether. The next closest player to him in terms of threes attempted in their pre-draft season was Pat Williams with the Chicago Bulls at 50. And nearly everyone else you're looking at had, you know, over 100 attempted threes in that pre-draft season. Their career NBA three-point shooters above 34%. And I'm being very nice with that 34% mark, by the way. NBA average now is actually about 36% with the three-point boom we've seen over the last 5-6 years. But most of these guys are if they're good shooters in the NBA, they were good shooters when they were coming in, And they had plenty of reps to become better shooters before they even set foot on an NBA floor. So that just your initial thoughts on hearing some of those numbers. Does anything stand out to you, surprise you about what I said there? Because that I think paints a picture of just what an outlier type of development this could be if Ryan Dunn holds on to shoot, let's even be more generous. Let's say like a 33% three-point mark at this point.
Yeah, and I think that's realistic for him because, and again, going back to development talk, I think so many coaches or trainers, that they're always trying to prepare their guys to be successful. One thing we say that we do is we're going to prepare these guys to fail. Like, we know they're going to fail and hit a wall. Who could get out of that slump quicker? Who has, you know, a level of self-belief? Who has a better plan or the mechanics to adjust? You know, did you build something that lasts? So the numbers don't, I mean, with Ryan, obviously they're very surprising this quick, but I think it goes back to just where we are in basketball. Your lens, it could be you, it could be me, it could be the front office of any NBA team. Like, how are you viewing the player, or, you know, like, what lens are you viewing the player through, or what lens are you viewing the team through or development through? If it's all analytic based, you could almost find something you're always looking for, or, you know, you're always going to have a right, wrong, whatever. But, you know, I got to work with Mark Dagnall in the G League, and he'd always talk about this, and obviously had a ton of success in Oklahoma City now, but we're playing an imperfect game with imperfect people. Like, numbers aren't always just going to be the direct answer. There are other things that go into it evaluation-wise or performance-wise to where a guy like Ryan Dunn, you do find a diamond in the rough, or someone is experiencing quicker results than anyone else expected.
No, 100%. By the way, an important caveat. I apologize to the audience. That was 41 players under the age of 25 in the NBA. I promise a lot more are shooting better than 34% in the NBA right now at greater numbers. But when you take a look at Ryan's shot specifically, right? And I watched some of his high school stuff that was available to that I could pull up on Synergy. I obviously watched all of his Virginia attempts from behind the arc, like just some of the things that I noticed, right? He had an inconsistent base in his shot, right? That varied from shot to shot. He had some going on with that guide hand, you know, so affecting some shots and the spin on the ball and the arc in some funky ways. Inconsistent release point, I think, was probably the biggest one for me, shooting it on the way up more often than necessarily at the apex of his jump. But you're watching the threes that he's taken in the NBA now, Phil, and even the ones that he's missing. Most of those things I just said seem cleaned up, And to what you're talking about, a lot of this stuff in regards to developing a shot, a lot of it takes place over multiple off seasons, not just one. So I'm not necessarily looking to break it down in the sense of this is a specific science that worked for Ryan. It's a one size fit all approach. Cause as we talked about, it's obviously not, but I think the thing I want to just ask about Ryan before we kind of zoom out and look at everything holistically is to be able to make those adjustments and seemingly have them stick as quickly as they are at the NBA level, obviously some high school success aside, but it takes a special person and a special worker to make those adjustments and really implement them as quick as he has. Like in working with Ryan, and like, what are some of the things you've noticed from him as a player and as a person to maybe lead you down the path of, I'm not necessarily fully surprised to see this from someone or one of my clients I work with. Like, what has he been like as a person when you got to work with him?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because this really actually goes into his shooting development too, and why some of this stuff worked for him and why he stuck with it. And again, there are people, I'm sure, in his life and other trainers. He didn't do the full pre-draft process with me. He did that with his agency. Mm-hmm. I had him for 3 weeks before that to really refine and retune and sharpen that stuff and for him to stick with it. But what makes Ryan, I think, really, really special, he has character and he has intelligence. And intelligence is so underrated sometimes. And I'm not saying you've got to be the smartest dude in the room. Like, I was a PE major. I'm not probably not very bright, you know, at some things. But Ryan had a level of intelligence to listen to the right people, to feel something biomechanically and knew it would work and be able to repeat it. Some guys aren't smart enough to feel those things biomechanically and repeat them. He was also intelligent enough to lock in on a term or a cue or a teaching point, kind of like you were talking about, inconsistent release point. Like, we had a two-word phrase that we wanted to get to, and he was smart enough to think on that and really concentrate on that while he was doing his work. You know, Doc said this a couple years ago. I steal it all the time. As competition increases, execution decreases. Not just 5-on-5, you know what I mean? Not just the side out of bounds play, but like once speed or distance or movement or competition increases, now their concentration, their level of execution on the steps of the process that are going to help them make a shot, those start to eliminate or they go by the wayside. Where Ryan's level of intelligence, you know, socially, emotionally, of course, great. Character, of course, great. But man, he has a level of intelligence about his own game and his biomechanics and his shot that he could take to the next level that was going to make him really, really good.
Working with players, this can apply to young players. This can apply to vets who are looking to take a shooting leap specifically. What are some of the things you noticed mechanically with players? Like, what's like one thing that you really have seen common that really needs to be adapted and fixed or revamped? Like, what's the most common thing you've seen with shooting in regards to development?
Well, Nate, I don't really want to answer this question because too many of you guys who like wear glasses, get that you think you all have this stuff figured out. Like, you're really, really smart, but you're not in the trenches freaking doing it. But you were right. Something you just said.
That's why I wanted to have you on, though. That's exactly why we're talking, Phil. That's why we're here.
I'm not here to make you look good because you're just a media. Like, hey, we can't let these media guys think they're too smart, you know. But here's what you said. The inconsistencies with his footwork and base and balance, that's universal. That's where we start with everybody. And that's a philosophical thing for me. We believe the number one predictor of making a shot in the NBA is base and balance. And that's just not up to Phil Beckner. You know where I got a lot of this stuff from? The players I've trained. The players will tell you what works and what doesn't. You can't fool these guys. You either know your crap or you don't. So the thing that I think is lacking so much, whether it's a vet, whether it's a young rookie, we call it Hall of Fame footwork. Like, you got to work on your footwork to at a Hall of Fame level. And if you could do that, then your base and balance gets way, way better. And if your base and balance gets way, way better, now the technical part, the fundamental part of our shooting is easier to adjust. But if your brain is having to think, oh, I got to get this foot down, I got to get on balance, and then you're trying to mechanically get that ball on a track or shoot it straight, it's going to be so hard for your brain and your body to connect to get that done. So again, not gassing you up, but man, base imbalance is where we start. And I love what you said. And for any coaches or trainers, again, they could reach out to me on social media or email or website, whatever. I'd love to help them with any questions. But here's what I would say. Chip England said this. Chip England's like a great, great, you know, shooting coach, one of the best ever. And I got to spend a little bit of time with him. I remember he told me, he's like, a lot of shots look the same, but they're kind of like a fingerprint. They're all distinctly different. And I'm not going to say any names. There's some people that really, really bug me out there sometimes. Whether they're on social media, they try to get every player to shoot the exact same way or shoot like them when they were a player. Like, I could really shoot the ball, but if you looked at my shot, it looks a little funky. I was a white NAIA player who lost a bunch of games. Like, I'm not going to try to get Dame or Ant or Jacoby or Ryan to shoot like me. We want them to shoot the best version of their shot. Eliminating what's bad, maximizing what's good within their shot. I'm not going to try to get Ryan Dunn, who's 6'7" and long and great wingspan, to shoot like a guy like Dame, who's 6'2". Like, that's probably not very good coaching. They're not built the same biomechanically. So
what you just said reminds me specifically of a lot of the conversation around Lonzo Ball when he was coming into the NBA. Mm. Everyone was screaming at the top of their lungs for him to change his shot altogether, when in reality, that's not necessarily what happened. He made some adjustments to his shot, which has now allowed him to be, you know, a good NBA three-point shooter, a great NBA three-point shooter when he's on the floor. But he didn't have to revamp and completely change the wheel. He just made some quick adaptations, and he ultimately stayed comfortable with something that for the most part worked for him.
And we believe in that, and that's our philosophy. Some people have other philosophies, and it might work, you know what? But that's just what we believe in, and we're going to move forward with that. So yeah, I couldn't agree more with that.
You called us out, us basketball nerds, scouts, analysts, number crunchers, whatever term you want to use. I do want to ask a question about when we're watching. So I usually use, some people actually do this in reverse. I use the numbers to be able to help me ask the questions that I need to, and I use the tape to confirm the answers to those questions. Some people do it the other way around. That's how I do it. When I'm trying to evaluate how good of a shooter someone either is or could be, it's one thing to look at the raw three-point percentage. I think a lot of people are trending towards, you know, the volume and the number of shots these guys are actually getting up and the context of those shots to use, which is good. There's some other indicators too that people have thrown around, like using finishing numbers, right? Like, how do these guys do on floaters runners
around
the basket, from the free throw line? Like, how much do you actually add into some of these other indicators in terms of trying to determine what, you know, how far a player is in their shooting development?
Yeah, personally, the two I believe in is free throws and floaters, because I think that shows, you know, a level of, you know, hand-eye coordination or depth perception just instinctively that guys might have in them. But, you know, it circles back. You said something a little bit ago. You know, when you just look at raw data, you can't see what's behind the scenes. I worked with Mikal Bridges his second year in Phoenix, and he started off not making very many shots. And if you would have just looked at his percentage, and he was coming off the bench, they had just hired Monty Williams. He didn't know when he was going to play, if he'd shoot the ball. One game he'd shoot 1-3, next game he'd shoot 4, the next game he'd shoot 0. So you don't know. But if you just looked at it, you're like, man, this guy can't shoot anymore. He's at 30%. Well, he wasn't getting attempts. Was he getting shots out of his spot? Are they taking the right one? A lot of these coaches or trainers, like, they don't coach shot selection. One thing, you know, Dame and Ant being two of my full-time guys, it's almost like part of our contract. Like, guys, you're going to let me coach your shot selection. You're going to let me give feedback. Now, you could choose whether you shoot them or not shoot them, but I'm going to tell you when it's a bad shot, or we're going to sit there and look and agree. So when you said looking at it on film, and I want to go back to Ryan Dunn for a second. Yeah, there were a lot of things to clean up. Like, he – and I think the biggest adjustment we made, because it wasn't just this year, and the story is kind of unique, how we got connected in Phoenix and his dad was out there. His dad's like this great mastermind, kind of his development, had this vision that he believed in. He's like, we just got to find the right people, you know. But the year before, we worked on two things with Ryan. And this was even before Virginia. And it was still hard for him to get it, you know, in role and situation, all that in Virginia. Mm-hmm. But getting way more consistent footwork, one. And then two, shooting the ball instead of throwing the ball. Like, because you would throw it, you would try so hard, you know, and that's our terminology. But here's what you could see now. And when you look at Ryan, even in summer league, when he started to get these attempts up, what we believe in, and I got to fight a lot of guys on this, and this isn't something I think you could see on paper. Like, you got to watch the tape and be old school. And I write this stuff down. Shot selection, right? One, are they good or bad shot? But then after that, is it a good or a bad miss? And we had to get Ryan.
I love this. The types of misses. Yes. Yes. I was big on.
We had to get Ryan even in workout, because especially with guys who are developing shooters, like you talked about earlier, some of these young guys, if he could shoot, as soon as they see a miss, they think it's fail or succeed. Oh, I missed. It was bad. Miss. No. Like, if we could get that ball straight more often, there we go. If we could get that ball deeper more often, there we go. To us, we really believe there's a difference between good and bad misses. So you hear me all the time in workouts, good miss, good miss, good miss, good reps, because we want to build a foundation. Our whole shooting program, Nate, we call it foundation shooting. Dame loves it so much, and it helped him build the deep ball. He's like, we ain't giving it to everybody. Whether it works or not, or just, you know, these guys are competitors, but what are we doing? We're building a foundation. And once you have a strong foundation, now you could take those next level, those next steps to get to the next level in your shooting development. For Dame, that was going from good to great to elite. Dame has a chance to finish number two and threes all time under Steph. For Ant, that, you know, he has a different level in his shooting development, but you got to have a foundation. And in order to build that foundation, you have to get your footwork. We call it your track good enough to shoot a consistent ball. And then when you shoot a consistent ball, we're going to decide good miss, bad miss, and be okay with good misses, because we know we're developing and we're getting better.
I love that. Good misses, bad misses. I also talk about some basketball nerd stuff. I also like looking at the makes too. And I'm not going to say there's anything is like a bad make, but I would say there's good makes and there's better makes. Cause whether that ball is actually swishing through the net every single time, you can't hear a sound, or if it's clanking around the rim, like that, to me, that was going back to some of the people who I learned some of this stuff from. That was something that I've definitely taken away in my time.
Nate, you can't miss that either in development. I literally just worked with Nurkic in Phoenix on Monday before I flew to Milwaukee. It was Sunday. They played Monday. But he's a guy, and again, we don't publicize all this stuff, but like he went, since working with us, he's increased his free throw percentage by like 10% or something, at least a couple years. I mean, he made a major jump in it. And, you know, we start working out. We do our ball handling. We do a little foundation shooting. This was literally just Sunday night in Phoenix. We make two adjustments, one with his posture, the second one with his track. His next five free throws, he had made, you know, plenty before that. His next five free throws that night were all swishes. That means we increased what we call it. We increased his quality of make. That means your ball is deeper. It's more accurate. And if you have a better quality of make, that means when you're a little inaccurate, it's probably going in anyway. So one thing you talk about, some of these guys I've worked with, even Jacoby Walter and Ryan Dunn, we have a philosophy in workouts. You'll love this. Like, and I'm just going to start calling you the basketball nerd. Like, you'll nerd out on this one.
Please. Yeah.
If it's too much rim, or if the ball bounces once, bounces twice, and then goes in, we don't count those as a make. So if you got to make 10 at a spot, that doesn't count as a make. But what we say, and players love this, we say prove it. That means if you take and make the next one with a clean make, doesn't have to be an exact swish, but if you prove it and the next one is quality, you get the last one and this one. So like if you're on 8, right, and you shoot and it doesn't completely go in all the way, 9 doesn't count unless you make 10 really, really good. And so we build there. Unless, and this is where like the arguments occur, unless it's competition, score time drill, one guy shoot, every make counts then. Whenever it's competition, we count every make.
Since you talked about Nurkic, I want to ask one more question before I ask the last overarching question given to the scouting podcast. But you touched on a big man, right? And center specifically, shooting and what that's looking like in today's NBA, because everyone's trying to use the buzz phrase of five out offense, and what does that look like, and what does that actually mean? And to me, that doesn't necessarily mean that you need someone, like you need a big man who's attempting 5, 6, 7, 8 threes a game. To me, that there's a lot of other things that go into a five out offense. And for in my opinion, you can settle this, but if you're asking your center to step outside the arc for the sole purpose of just bombing threes almost every time that they touch it, in my opinion, you're taking away from what the other special things they can do on the floor at that size. So like, what's kind of your whole opinion on big men shooting and volume and sort of where the league's at with five out offense from a center perspective?
Yeah, I think that's coaching philosophy. You know, how you want to play, style of play, but you can't let your greatest strength become your greatest weakness. We know that in any form of development. But I think, too, and some of these things are hard to measure because, again, and now, you know, we're having fun here, but all these analytic nerds, they think you just got to do this, do this, do this. Well, how about, like, I don't know if there's an example, and again, I ain't the smartest guy.
Well, it's usually easier said than done is probably your first comment to the people who say that, right?
But, like, how many times could we have got a better three if that big would have just rolled hard and put pressure on the rim? Bingo. Now maybe yep. The guy's shaping up out of the corner, and that guy's a 42% shooter, and we put some pressure on the rim, or maybe they open up more in the fourth quarter. I don't know. But, again, I don't – and maybe it's just life. Maybe it's basketball. You know, like I said, I speak on just high performance now with companies. Like, I don't think we have to live in a world of absolutes, whether it's Nurk or Brook Lopez or do they have to shoot six every time? What if it's better for these guys to roll to the rim and sprint to the rim and they just have a healthy mix of that? Well, then you're probably really hard to guard. And I said this the other day, and I'm not knocking anyone online. I respect, you know, what other people do, but we're all going to have different philosophies. It seems like right now, some people just want to sound really, really smart and reinvent the game. Like, let's go to shooting coaches.
You're not wrong. Yeah.
About shooting coaches or gurus. If the first thing they're looking for is like, how do you hold the ball and hands on the ball and this and that? I tell players, like, run from that dude. Like, let's get your posture, your footwork. Let's get your balance. Let's get all that better. Then I'll look at how you, hold the ball. Because if you're off balance, it don't matter. Same thing with all these great terms and analytics and different. If we live in this world of absolutes, like, well, then why don't we just become scientists instead of freaking coaches? Because going back to what I said earlier, like, we're coaching imperfect people in an imperfect game. And the game of basketball, not like all sports, is played in transition. Football, they reset the ball. You know what I mean? Soccer, hockey, basketball, it's played in transition. It's hard. It's fast. Baseball, they reset. Football, they reset. So, like, why are we trying to turn so many things into a science when we're dealing with people? And you've heard this forever, and I know you know, but, like, coaching is not a science. It's an art. Like, it's an art to figure this stuff out. And that goes back to just so much player development, shooting philosophy. And I think it's really allowed us to have results with players or results with certain players that maybe other people couldn't have got them to have. You know, because then Ryan Dunn, he's more confident. We didn't just make it a science, a technical adjustment every single day. Because if he won't get the number of attempts up with the level of confidence, I don't care if he's throwing the ball or shooting the ball. It won't matter because you won't shoot it anyways. Sorry, you got me going on that one. But yes, bigs, they need to shoot it. I wish they'd run to the rim more still. Let the guy shape up out of the corner and, you know, shoot a three or drive a closeout from there.
Listen, one of the best teams in the NBA right now is obviously the Oklahoma City Thunder with what they're doing with youth and how they've sort of gotten everyone to buy in. They've drafted and developed specific types of players. To me, it's not just the whole dribble pass shoot phenomenon for Oklahoma. To me, their secret sauce is actually their cutting and how often these guys cut and how much they actually see and how they're able to process that quickly. And I mean, that in my opinion was also the great Warriors dynasty had the secret sauce of Steph Curry that no one can replicate. But again, a lot of the same types of principles in their offense as well. So you're preaching to the choir on that one, my friend. I agree with you 100%. So just one last question to tie all this together, because we are a scouting podcast and a scouting network at the end of the day. So speaking to a scout or an analyst, someone who's trying to do this job from the sense of projection, not everything is linear. Obviously, outliers happen. I love when outliers happen. I love when chaos is introduced. But if you're speaking to someone on that side of the fence, what would be your advice and advisement in terms of some of the things that we can look for when trying to project shooting forward for all the basketball nerds out there.
Man, Nate, you've done a hell of a job with this. Seriously, like I've had fun. This has been one of the more fun podcasts. I haven't got to talk shooting as much. But to give you guys this, here's what I would say. One, about shooting, but then two, just like young development, you know, and would love to have you guys out or anyone, you know, Damon and I do the Formula Zero Camp with top high school and college players. We opened it up to people last year to come and watch. You know, if you guys want to come and watch, get out. You could see this stuff. But here's what I would say I think is undervalued or underseen is how guys move biomechanically and how they are built biomechanically. And I think the only reason I've gotten maybe halfway good at this, I'm not saying I'm an expert, but because I'm around these dudes all the time. And it's like, think about it. I've worked out Matisse Thybulle, Najee Marshall, Ryan Dunn, Quentin Grimes, Jarrett Culver, Jacoby Walter in pre-draft. How about all those guys for wings? Do you think I could tell you, oh, this guy is stiff. Oh, this guy's shoulders don't move. Oh, this guy has a pro body. Oh, this guy, his brain and his body click and he could fit. Like, I've done it with these guys. So here's what I would say. The part of the biomechanic thing, and I talk about this all the time at clinics, the best players that like get better, the best players are usually the best movers. So let's take that to shooting. How does the ball move in coordination with their ball, their knees, and their elbow? How does that move together? You know, and I almost said Steph. I shouldn't use Steph and Dame. I get it. They're the freak. They're freaks. But like, they move a certain way when they dip and they move and they catch and all, you know, and there's the catch high, keep it high. You know, I get all that stuff. I'm not, again, not speaking in absolutes, but the best players are usually the best movers. And then the elite players are the best movers with the ball in their hands. My favorite player in the league, Dame knows this. I mean, Dame's family, but like Devin Booker. That dude, how he moves biomechanically and how he moves with the ball in his hand and his level of precision. I show book clips. I've never worked with him. I want to someday. I'd even get his freaking autograph. That's how much I love him. Like how he moves, we call it body ball movement. When you could identify those body ball movement traits within guys shooting the ball or even change pace, change direction, and then biomechanically, like I don't think stiff guys get better. They can. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be marginal. It's going to be small. Fluid guys get better. Guys who can move their body. So that's
how about all- how about Dalton Connect on that front? How about him coming into the NBA? Right, like that's a guy.
Size, movement, fluidity. Look what he does. And he went JUCO to Northern Colorado to Tennessee. Like that. Those are no brainers. Like, and also he's going to be able to continue to get better because he's not stiff. He's not stuck.
I mean, the biggest thing with Connect when I was watching him last season was just the type of offensive load he undertook, but also the shots that came out of that offensive load, right? How much of a scorer he was compared to just only being a shooter at that volume with how efficient he was, the type of conditioning he had to have been in to take on that role. That's why I was like, oh, this guy, he was one of my favorite prospects last year. He's going to be a special player in the NBA for a long time. But Phil, I really appreciate you coming on. I agree. This has been one of the best podcasts I've ever done. This is incredible this is content for everyone out there listening. Just anything you want to plug for yourself. You talked about the Formula Zero Camp, but anything you're doing specifically that you want to plug to anyone out there.
Not so much plug it, but if we could ever do anything for, you know, I would say you, your team, your organization, reach out. I'm on Twitter, you know, pretty active on that. Or, you know, check out our website, drivenbball.com. Reach out to us. We do clinics, mentorship groups, training, you know, any of that stuff. So if there's any way we could serve or help, you know, you or your team, you know, or you got a question, don't hesitate to reach out to me or my guys, and we'll try to see what we could do for you.
Oh, trust me, we're taking you up on that offer, Phil. We're going to take you up on that, definitely. So thank you everyone out there for listening to this episode of the No Ceilings NBA podcast. Please make sure you subscribe to this podcast feed. Wherever you get your podcast, make sure you subscribe to us online, NoCeilingsNBA.com. Both NBA and college are in full swing. I'm going to be doing some G League coverage as well this year. So basketball's going. We're going to have words and thoughts about all of it. Make sure you're locked in. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day.